Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 229, and we're going to talk about the spirit of van life, the meaning of van life, what is the purpose of van life, and does it actually have one? We're also going to be talking about the importance of bench testing, which I can't recommend more highly than I do. A tale from the road involving a moth, and a product review of a trash can. Because we're always trying to keep it classy here. No, actually, folks, I'm not trying to keep it classy. I'm trying to keep it real. And trash cans are a real thing. A big pain in the butt on it. Okay. Hi. Welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's nice to be chatting with, or at least at you, once again this week. Hey, the Discord channel, which you can find, I think, if you search, it's Built to Go, a Discord channel. It's at builttogo.com. There's a link at the top of the page. It's not the world's most active Discord channel, but it's active enough that we've had some interesting conversations lately. And one of our regulars is a man who goes by the name of Curious Toad. And Curious Toad is a writer as well as a van lifer, and he has a very intriguing website called thecurioustoad.com. And I highly recommend those of you who are curious, which I hope all of you are, well, head over there and check it out. And he posted an article on the Discord channel recently that got some engagement. People were pretty happy with what he had to say. And I thought I would share that with you, read some excerpts from it, encourage you to read it entirely on your own, of course, and then pick a bone with it. Well, anyway, let me just jump into it. You might disagree with me on this one, and that is always fine. If anyone has any strong feelings they wish to communicate to me, they can get a hold of me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. So the gentleman's name is Todd Rowley. I can share that with you because he posted it on his website. There's no secrets there. And he posted an article called Van Life Unfiltered: Adventure, Simplicity, and Self-Discovery in a Changing Trend, which is an excellent title, and that's exactly what he addresses here. So he starts off, most of us in the Western world live in a time and place that feels overloaded with distractions and complexities, making the idea of packing up a van and hitting the open road deeply appealing to many. Complete agreement. That is absolutely a big part of the reason I'm involved in van life. Honestly, whenever things get overwhelming, I've got too many tasks to do or whatever, I think I really wish I could just lock myself in the van and hit the road and, like, even turn off the internet for a while. And that's the tack he's taking here with this article. But he goes on. The hashtag van life movement, once a small community of adventurers and minimalists, has surged in popularity, captivating people with images of endless horizons, cozy van interiors, and a life unbound by routine. Again, yes, he goes on. But as the hashtag van life trends across social media, the spirit of the movement, adventure, simplicity, and self-discovery, seems to be getting lost in a wave of luxury conversions and RV-like builds. For many, including myself, the heart of van life is still about shedding excess, embracing uncertainty, and discovering who you are when you leave behind the noise. The next section is called The Essence of True Van Life: Adventure and Freedom. At its core, van life isn't about the van itself, it's about what the van represents, an opportunity to reconnect with adventure, nature, and yourself. Further down the article, he has a good comment here. Van life has a way of forcing introspection. When you live in a small space, every decision about what to bring and what to leave behind becomes significant. The same goes for mental clutter. There's less room for superficial worries and more space to focus on what really matters. He's never owned a 2011 diesel Sprinter ambulance, I can tell, because the superficial worries are well justified in that case. He then goes on with the rise of luxury builds. Has van life lost its way? And in there, he says, this shift has diluted the true spirit of van life. What was once about embracing the unknown and finding joy in simplicity has, for some, become a pursuit of material perfection. The more elaborate the build, the further it seems to stray from the essence of the movement. Living with less, experiencing more, and seeking adventure over luxury. Much of the rest of the article is about why simplicity and minimalism. I did a podcast on minimalism many, many moons ago where I laid out the different approaches to minimalism. Minimalism isn't just one thing. Lots of different people have different ideas of what minimalism is, and maybe you can see where I'm going with this. But in conclusion, Todd says, how to stay true to the spirit of van life. And this is the list he has, although he goes into a lot more detail. 1. Embrace imperfection. Very wise advice, in my opinion. 2. Prioritize experience over things. For me, certainly the memories I have of all the travel I did in the 70s are much more important than whatever toy I had at the time. 3. Travel light, live fully. Absolutely, that is something I subscribe to. 4. Stay open to the journey. Yes, I agree with that entirely. 5. Connect with nature. Another great thing. And that's Todd's thesis, or hypothesis, or proposal. That van life has a set of rules. We should follow those rules to get the most out of it. And I think a great number of people who are doing van life will absolutely agree with this and find it to be an inspiring article, and you might too. So please go read it for yourself, because obviously he goes into a lot more depth than me just skimming the article for you. So you might think, well, you just agreed with everything he said. What's the problem? And there isn't a problem. What there is a different perspective. So I don't disagree with a single thing he writes in this article. I only disagree with a few words, and they're individual words. They're not a paragraph. Those words are true, spirit, and heart. What's my issue with those words? Well, what Todd has done here is tried to bring people back to the perspective of, hey guys, you don't have to have a $225,000 Airstream camper van to do van life. And yeah, I agree 100%. The flip side is, you can have a $225,000 Airstream and do van life. It's not exclusive. Now, this is my perspective. I've been told I'm wrong many times on this. I remember way back when I first started doing this podcast, I was criticized for diluting van life by including vans that weren't Volkswagen buses. That was a thing. You had to be in a Volkswagen bus or you weren't doing van life. I also was accused of diluting the movement because I have a home that is not a van. I was called a housey. At the time, actually, I lived in an actual house, not a condo like I do now. And that made me a poser and artificial, and I was mixing the message with those people who lived in vans full-time. And then there was a further division there, where the people who lived in vans full-time were the people who chose to versus the people who had to. And one group was infringing on the other. We talk about this all the time on the podcast. And you can see the problem here. And you can see what my minor, very minor, issue is with the Curious Toad's post. By all means, I agree with everything the Curious Toad said. The thing I'm taking issue with is that this is one perspective, and I don't think we need to minimalize other perspectives. You should be doing van life because you want to do van life, and you should define it the way you want to. That's my perspective. And while I agree, for me, with almost everything in the post by Todd, I am completely respectful and supportive of people who are doing van life for other reasons. For example, if you really want to live in a house, but for whatever reason, life circumstances dictate that you have to live in a 1991 Dodge Caravan, and folks, there's a lot of people in that situation. I completely support you, and I completely understand that you and I have some of the same problems to overcome, but we are living in completely different circumstances. I appreciate that difference, but I don't want that difference to put me in a camp that's separate from yours, where I can't support you in yours. By the same token, if you have the $225,000 Airstream camper van and you also have the $500,000 yacht that's parked down in Fort Lauderdale somewhere, that's okay too. For me, I want to share our commonalities. And the commonalities we have is that while I'm nowhere near being able to afford that camper van, despite owning an actual Airstream myself, a significantly less expensive one, we do have common problems. We still have to worry about black tanks. We still have to worry about 12-volt versus 110-volt power. We have to worry about combating the elements. Rust, decay, travel, planning, all these things we still have in common. And that's what I would like to encourage. Let's find our commonality and drill down on those things to help everybody accomplish their goals, and those goals might be different things. That's all. I'm certainly not trying to give Todd a hard time. In fact, I'm trying to encourage Todd to write more, and I did have a brief chat with him about this before I brought this up, so don't feel like I'm putting Todd on blast or anything like that. It's absolutely not the case. I want to see more content like the content that Todd the Curious Toad is creating. But I still want to point out that we are a big tent, so to speak, a big, mostly metal tent that happens to have wheels, and I don't want that message to get lost. So feel free to attack all you'd like. I love attacks. Feel free to interact in any way. You can get a hold of me, like I said, at email at jeff@builttogo.com, or you can find me on Facebook in Built to Go, a Facebook group, or you can join our Discord server at Built to Go, a Discord server. Links for all of these are at builttogo.com. Special thanks to Dave from Canada, who gave me one of the highest compliments I have ever received in my life when he compared me to Steve Wallace from Camping with Steve. Thanks very much, Dave. I really appreciate the compliment and the support. And because of Dave and other folks like Dave, including the monthly supporters, there are no ads in this podcast, and we will continue to have no ads in this podcast for quite some time now. Thank you, guys. If you would like to help support the no-ad plan, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3.1. And buy me a gallon of diesel or so, and we will all get there together. Thank you. Van Life News! Oh, it seems like every week I'm posting the same kind of news, and that's how the news is. You know, there are trends, people follow the trends. If it bleeds, it leads. You've heard all that. So it's actually a little bit difficult to find good news about van life because people just aren't reporting it. I will continue to work harder on that because I understand the bias is in the way the news is reported. That content is out there. Good things are happening. I just have to work harder at finding it. But this week we've kind of got a mixed bag. The first thing is from Tucson, which I always remember how to spell by saying Tucson in my head. But the Tucson City Council is voting to ban camping in washes. Now, this is a complicated thing. First off, if you're not from the West or you haven't traveled there a lot, you may not know what a wash is. They're basically flat places where nobody will ever build a house that folks use for camping, because most of the time, washes are completely dry and flat, and there aren't any plants there. It's a very easy place to set up a camp. The problem is, well, there's two problems, actually. The first problem is that 1% of the time, the wash, as the name suggests, is a raging torrent of water. And the rare times when it rains in the desert, all that rain collects and goes down the washes, often with great force, and often miles and miles away from where the storm that created the water might be. So it's deceiving. You can be sitting in a wash on a sunny day, and suddenly a 2-foot wall of water going 30 miles an hour rushes down the wash and hits you. That's the nature of the desert. So camping in washes has an inherent risk. And that is the reason being cited for banning camping in washes. And I know folks camp in washes in camper vans. It is a thing. I get it. Most of the time it's fine, except for those few times when it's not. However, as you may have suspected, the stated reason may not be the real reason. And yes, folks, this is another anti-homeless bill. They are trying to push homeless folks, or the unhoused, if you prefer, out of Tucson. Get out of here. We don't want you here. That is the message, and we keep hearing that message over and over and over. And now it is being codified into law because of the Supreme Court saying that Grants Pass, Oregon had the right to make quote-unquote camping on public land illegal. I don't know what to tell you. I just see a trend here. And this trend will bleed over into van life at large. These towns, after they're done removing all the homeless people, where are they going to go, by the way? They're going to use these same laws to prevent you from parking in a park and cooking lunch. That's my prediction. So I'm going to keep following this. I'm not happy with this trend. I understand there are real issues with homelessness and, yes, real issues with camping and washes. But I don't like it. On a sadder and yet happier note, a cat, meow, lost during a camping trip treks 900 miles in the right direction. So you may have heard these stories about people's pets get lost or someone moves or whatever, and then the pet shows up 3 years later, 1,200 miles later, you know. And yes, there have been movies made of this and such, but this is a real story here. And it was reported in Boing Boing. Links to all these stories in the show notes, of course. The story is pretty simple. A cat by the name, and I know, everybody wants to know the name of the cat. That's the most important part of the story, right? The name of the cat is, and I don't know how to pronounce this necessarily, is Rainbow. Oh, now I get it. R-A-Y-N-E-B-E-A-U. So, Rainbow. The cat belonged to Benny and Suzanne Aguiano, and it ran away from their campsite into the woods in Yellowstone in Wyoming, and they searched for days and couldn't find the cat. So they gave up, but they left information, you know, hey, if anyone found the cat was chipped, they did everything right, but, I mean, what are you going to do? The cat could have been eaten by a coyote or something, you know, you don't know what happened, so you have to move on with your life. And they were sad, they thought that was the end of the cat, and they thought they'd never find out what happened, and then they got a phone call 2 months later from Roseville, California. Now, you have to look at the article, or at least look at a map for this. Yellowstone is way up in Wyoming. Roseville is in the central part of California, maybe a little bit north central, kind of west of Reno, 900 miles away over the Continental Divide. That's where the cat was found. And that is only 200 miles from where the cat lived in Salinas. So this cat was going home and was interrupted. They said the cat had really beaten up paws, it had lost 40% of its weight, and really low protein levels because it wasn't eating properly. So basically the cat was living on its own. It was if it had a van, it would have been living in it, but it didn't. And they really don't know the story. I mean, having the cat chip doesn't mean they have GPS on it all the time. But it does prove that it was the same cat that left Yellowstone and was making its way to Salinas. And you hear these stories and sometimes you're like, well, there's a lot of cats. It's probably a cat that just looks exactly the same. But no, in this case, we have proof. It's the exact same cat. So, folks, keep an eye on your cats. They will wander. But if your cat wanders, there's a very, very, very slight chance it's wandering home. At any rate, chip your cats and dogs if you're going to camp with them. And this next article, I feel like I just have to talk about. This is in Wired. Because of the recent spate of news from the Middle East, I know there's been a lot of news from the Middle East, but the one that impacts van life the most for us anyway is, you know, is your phone going to explode because somebody typed some numbers 1,000 miles away? Yeah, you probably have heard of the exploding pager and walkie-talkie attack that happened in the Middle East. That's all I'm going to say about that. We're not going to be talking about politics or religion in this podcast. However, it is reasonable to have some fears that are all phones and pagers and walkie-talkies actually bombs? And in a different Discord server, I had a lengthy conversation with some fairly technical folks about, you know, there's a lot of energy stored in a battery. Is there a way to, like, hack the BMS so that the battery releases all its energy at once? Isn't that a bomb? Etc., etc., etc. And while there might be some very esoteric feasibility to that, it turns out that maybe, perhaps, and again, I'm not telling you this to worry about this. Don't worry about this. But yeah, the lithium battery could catch fire. There might be a way to do that. That isn't what happened here. According to most reporting now, these devices had been tampered with and there was a very tiny bit of explosive put in them. So folks, you do not have this explosive in your phones and pagers or whatever. This was a targeted attack. These devices were intercepted in their transit from their owners. The owners were known to the attackers by and large, etc. So, bottom line, you can read this article called Your Phone Won't Be the Next Exploding Pager. It will explain why, technically, you don't have to worry about this. But the important message is, you don't have to worry about this. At least not personally. There's plenty of reasons to be worried about the Middle East in general. Tech Talk. I was helping somebody in the Discord channel who purchased the same radio that I just installed in my truck, and they were having trouble with it. What I'm about to say has nothing to do with that particular problem. This is not a criticism or anything like that. It's just something that came to mind. And that is the importance of bench testing. And no, that doesn't mean you go to IKEA and stand on the bench to see if it'll support your weight. Not a bad idea, though. No, this means that you are going to test whatever you're installing on the bench first to make sure it works. For example, let's say you're installing a water pump into your van. If you're putting it into a difficult place or maybe behind panels where it's going to be difficult to access, imagine if you install that water pump and then it doesn't work. How do you troubleshoot it then? Well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to have to take it out, probably, or at least access it. And you're going to have to undo all that work you've done. That's a pain in the butt. It's not great. Plus, you've added more variabilities to the problem. And that's the purpose of bench testing. Bench testing would be you will take that pump, put it on your bench, hook it up to a power source. I actually have a power source I got on Amazon that's dedicated for this purpose, and make sure it works before you put it in the van. Then, if you put it in the van and it doesn't work, you know, well, the pump used to work, so I know it's not an inherent problem with the pump. It must be the wiring, the hoses, something like that. This is even more true with radios. For example, if you're installing a CB radio, it's very easy to bench test that. You just hook it up to power, turn it on. If it turns on, great. That's probably where you're going to have problems. And what I do when I'm installing something like this is I will do a continual bench test. Every time I make a major change, I test it. I will test it on the bench as much as I can. Then I will install it loosely with all the connections hooked up, but nothing mounted. Make sure that works. And sometimes this means you have to run wires awkwardly and use extension cables and all that. It's worth it. Make the effort. I know that when you're working on these things, you're just, I want to have this done. I want to finish it. I want to screw everything in and be completely done with it. Put that aside for a second. Take the time to make sure the thing continues working every single time. I had a weird problem recently in my van where my subwoofer stopped working. Now, I had bench tested the subwoofer. It was fine. And it had been working for weeks. And then it stopped. I'm like, well, did a connection come loose? What was it? Because I knew that I had bench tested it and I had live tested it. And then I obviously had been using it. Because of that, my troubleshooting was much simpler. What I really just had to do was look and see what changed. And you know what changed? I bought a product. And that'll be the product review. Product review! Yeah, trash cans aren't all that important. However, they can disable your subwoofer, it turns out. To continue the story from the Tech Talk segment, I bought this trash can, and the way I installed it, it actually hit a button on my subwoofer that I couldn't see and turned it off. So that was an easy troubleshooting thing, and it was the trash can's fault. But the trash can itself, actually, is a really cool thing, and I wanted to tell you about it. This trash can, all right, I understand, it's just a trash can. You can use a bag or a box or a gallon jug that you've cut the top off. There's a lot of ways to solve this problem. But I wanted a not unattractive place to put trash in while I was driving that was easy, not distracting, I didn't have to hunt around for it, and then hid the trash. Those were my criteria. So this trash can holds about a gallon. It is a cube or an elongated cube. At the top, there is... well, do you remember the Sarlacc from Star Wars? The creature that ate Boba Fett? It's like a hole with teeth. And that's what's on the top. And you basically put your trash in the teeth. You feed the Sarlacc. And then when you're ready to get rid of the trash, like probably at a gas station or whatever, you can just remove the whole trash can and the very secure lid flips open, stays attached, and then you can just dump it in the trash can there. And an important part is it comes with a strap that lets you hook it up someplace so it won't roll around your van. Honestly, it's $10 and it has completely solved the problem in a very neat way. It also has a band around the sides that let you put things like pens and stuff on it. So you have to see a picture of it to completely understand this thing. But if you're always looking for a place to put trash and you're tired of hanging a trash bag off your radio knobs or whatever you're doing, $10. It's one of these little things that will make your life more pleasant, and I highly recommend it. I actually bought mine at a truck stop on a whim, and I'm very glad I did, but I did find almost exactly the same thing on Amazon, and it is the Vankor, V-A-N-K-O-R, car trash can for, have to read the whole title, car cute, car trash bag, bin hanging, waterproof automotive, car garbage cans, leak-proof vehicle, trash can, black. Take that, SEO. And the good news for those of you who are much more fashion conscious than I, it comes in a whole bunch of different colors. And actually, this one's a little bigger. It holds 2.2 gallons. There's a 3-gallon version, too. Anyway, take a look. It's a pretty cool product, and I will probably have one of these in whatever vehicle I'm driving forever going forward. Link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. So, once upon a time, I lived in the woods of Loudoun County, Virginia, in Leesburg Township. And when we bought this old house on 9 acres of land, this was the boonies. We were way out. You know, by D.C. standards, and Leesburg is arguably a D.C. suburb, this was nowhere. I mean, we had little general stores. It was all dirt roads, tall trees, lots of farms. I mean, it was rural. Nowadays, it's like in the middle of 50,000 houses. It's completely different. I'm shocked looking at the satellite photos. But back then, it was the woods. And they were kind of cool woods. We drove up the driveway of this place looking at the house to see if we wanted to buy it. And we knew we were going to buy it just from the driveway because of the trees. These trees, and we hired an arborist to come out and walk the grounds with us to learn about the trees. These trees were dominated by these giant white oaks, Quercus albus, that were about 150 years old. And as we learned more about the property, we realized that we were on the grounds of an old plantation. Now, our house was built in the 50s. It wasn't that old. But originally, this was an old plantation that the Civil War put an end to. And these trees grew up in the fields that used to be plowed way back when. In fact, we even found what I think were the quarters of some enslaved people who worked the land. Now, there's some unfortunate history with this property. We found out that after the war, a bunch of newly freed people moved to this land and lived there, and they named the community after the one white woman who lived there, because that's what things were like back then. Her last name happened to be Watson. So if you want to find exactly where I'm talking about, it's Watson on Red Hill. The entire hill was called Red Hill, but that wasn't the original name either. And I will not be telling you what the original name was, because the original name involves a racial slur directly related to the people living there. And if you look on old maps, that's what it will say. So that's where we lived. Now, none of that history impacted the house. It was a very nice house. We loved living in the woods. And we had a number of strange experiences there, but this one is kind of cool. I was out in the backyard. We had a separate garage. I was working out there on, I think, a six-wheel drive ATV. Anyway, too many stories. But I noticed something moving on the ground, and I looked at it, and I was like, what is that? And it was a moth. It was a moth the size of my hand. It was the biggest moth I had ever seen. And I had seen Luna moths fairly often. If you've ever seen a Luna moth, it's very striking. They come out at night, hence the name, you know, Luna, not lunar, Luna. Green moths with a big swallowtail. Google that. I mean, they're amazing creatures. It's always a treat to see them. But I've seen them several times. You know, seeing one of those, I'm like, oh, cool. It's not like a life-changing thing. But this moth was so much bigger that I thought, wow, this is really exceptional. I'm so happy to be seeing this thing. So I looked it up on the internet, which this was about 2001 or 2002. So the internet was a little bit more primitive than it is now. And I was able to figure out what it was. And it was called a Cecropia, C-E-C-R-O-P-I-A moth, Cecropia moth. And it turned out to be the largest moth in North America. So I had that going for me. I had now seen the largest moth in North America. Completely friendly thing. It was crawling around on the ground, and I put my hand in front of it, and it crawled up on my hand, and not an unpleasant experience at all. I mean, they don't have mouth parts or stingers or anything like that. It's not like they can hurt you. But what amazed me was its weight. This moth was so big, it had weight. really, really impressive thing. And I looked up pictures of what the caterpillars look like, and honestly, they look like hot dogs. They're these massive... Well, they don't look like hot dogs. They're the same size as hot dogs. Imagine a hot dog crawling on a branch with about 100 legs and brightly... Okay, I'm perhaps going too far with this. Anyway, I was like, this is a very cool thing. Now, I didn't want to disturb the thing too much, so I put it on the ground back in the house and told my wife and kids, hey, there's a really cool thing out there. They were not as nature-y as I was, and they wouldn't come out, and it didn't matter. By the time I got out there again, it was gone, and I hope it had a very nice life. Although, from what I've read, very, very short lives. Now, this wasn't in the time when everyone had an iPhone in their pocket and they could take a picture of everything they saw, so I don't have any record of this. I'm a little sad about that. But then something happened that I have feelings about this. I'm not sure they're justified, but 2 weeks later in the news, the local news, there was an article about this amazing discovery. Some college professor had found a Cecropia moth, the first one recorded in Loudoun County in 100 years. It was this big article like, ooh, wow, oh. And I'm like, but I just saw one in my driveway 2 weeks ago. Heck, I saw it. I identified it. I had it. I could have documented it. I could have been the one in the article. And yeah, so what? You know, this story is one of those things that helps me put my life in perspective. So what? If you think about it, if I had taken that picture of the moth and went to the newspaper with it, they would have been like, okay, yeah, nice moth. Okay, see you later. Keep that subscription going. You know, they wouldn't have cared. The fact that a college professor, somebody with authority, says this, that's a totally different thing. And, you know, good. I'm glad that my identification was validated. I'm glad the story got out there. Maybe more people were able to look in their yards and find them. It's one of these funny things, like with the coelacanth. You remember the coelacanth, this living fossil, this fish that was extinct for years, and yet they found one, and holy cow, this fish is back from the dead or whatever. And yet there are stories of local populations like regularly eating these things because they didn't know they were missing. They just thought they were one of the fish that lives there. It's a little bit like that. For all we know, Cecropias have been living in the woods forever and just no one's seen them because they live a very short amount of time. They're actually kind of hard to see despite their size. So that was a good lesson for me. You might be lucky enough to see something rare. In fact, the more you live, the more chances there are for you to see something rare. But that doesn't necessarily mean you deserve anything for it. You can just enjoy the experience of seeing the rare thing. And that's enough. A place to visit. In a similar vein, if you would like to see giant Lepidoptera, there's a really easy way to do that, and that is, if you're ever in Key West, Florida, caveat, not the easiest place to van life in the world, but not impossible. Key West, Florida has a butterfly garden that is very easy to find, very easy to access, and actually quite lovely. Now, this is obviously a big tourist place. That's why it's down in Key West. Key West doesn't have any special butterfly pedigree or anything like that. But I think it's a nice little place to visit. And you basically walk into an aviary, a lepidopteriary? Is that the word? Maybe it's not. I don't know. Anyway, there's birds in there, so it's an aviary. And you just enjoy being in this room filled with birds and an unbelievable number of incredibly brightly colored butterflies. Now, this experience isn't for everyone. If you're freaked out by something landing in your hair or climbing on your face or something like that, this might not be the most pleasant thing in the world. But if you're okay with it, if you understand that butterflies are actually insects, you know, they're bugs, if you want to use the common term, and you think they're pretty, and you like the way they fly, and you want to see them feed and stuff, and the birds they have there are fascinating, yeah, this is a great place to go. It's right downtown. It's not hard to find. It's easy to walk to from the port. It's not far from the bars. I mean, it's Key West. Nothing's far from the bars. But I did it. I highly recommend it. And one of the cool things is that your, like, admission pass is actually a butterfly. It's a cardboard butterfly that I believe it's a blue morpho. It's actually very cool, and you can wear it on your hat or whatever all day long. Very clever advertising technique for them. And, of course, the gift shop is just about as big as the whole place. You know, you get it. This is a commercial and touristy place. But that doesn't matter. It's still worth a visit. So you can visit them online at keywestbutterfly.com, or you can just go to Key West and visit them on Duval Street, 1316 Duval Street, and they do have a free bus that goes around Duval Street, so depending on where you are, you don't even have to walk. Resource recommendation. We have so much media these days. If I were a kid and you could have told me that I could listen to basically any song ever recorded anytime I wanted to without hauling a record player around with me even, I wouldn't have believed it. And yet, my iPhone literally has access to every recorded song ever recorded, mostly, with some tiny exceptions. Books, the same, although it's a little bit harder with books, because you typically have to pay per book. There are subscription services. Books are not quite as democratized. But there is one place where books are as democratized as they can be while respecting copyright laws, and that is Project Gutenberg. You may have heard of Project Gutenberg. It is one of the original cool things that was on the internet. Gutenberg was the guy who invented the printing press. All right, you get that part. The project is basically trying to get as many books into your life as possible, as free as possible. Everything they have on their site is free. All the works of Mark Twain, on their site for free. Voltaire, on the site for free. Pride and Prejudice, on the site for free. All these books that you probably were assigned in high school and may or may not have read, they're on this site for free. And there are newer books too, like Cory Doctorow of the previously mentioned Boing Boing has released his books on Project Gutenberg, and anybody can read them. It's a very cool, very old thing. But one thing I wanted to point out is a lot of these books are also available in audio. Now, this is old school. For example, if you wanted to listen to Roughing It by Mark Twain, you wouldn't just download one file. They have every chapter broken down into a separate file, because back when this was created, it was a lot of work to download that much data, so they had to break it up. It's not true these days. So it will require a little bit of technical savvy. What I would recommend is that if you wanted to listen to Roughing It, you would download all the chapters and then bring them into Audacity or some other program and put them together. Or you could bring them into your music player and create a playlist and do it that way, which wouldn't be a bad way to do it, because then you could chapter through and such. It's a little bit complicated, but that doesn't matter. The point is, if you are somebody with limited resources or somebody who just doesn't want to pay for all this, a subscription to Audible or whatever, but you still want to listen to audiobooks, there's more than a lifetime's worth at Project Gutenberg, and I think it would be worth you checking out. So, the URL is extremely simple. It's gutenberg.org. Gutenberg is G-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G. And you will find something you like there. I almost guarantee it. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 229. Music, as always, is by Simon Wegg. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me at jeff@builttogo.com or on Facebook or on Discord. And those are the primary ways. I'm still struggling with Instagram. Until next time, remember the words of Carl Sagan, who said, "One glance at a book and you hear the voice of another person, perhaps someone dead for 1,000 years. To read is to voyage through time."